Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. As usual, when are consumed with this problem of protecting the country we love, top of mind is Communist China, the Chinese Communist Party that runs it. We are watching serious turmoil take place inside China now. It's becoming harder and harder for the party to conceal it, and it seems as though it is growing by the day. To talk about what is happening, as best we can discern it, inside the Chinese Communist Party itself, but most especially inside the economy of China, I'm very pleased to have with us Dr. Bradley Thayer. He is these days our duty expert on China at the Center for Security Policy. He runs our China program. He is also the author of several really important books, including one that is forthcoming. I'm very excited about Understanding the China Threat is its title. He is an essayist of considerable productivity, often at the Hill with his co-author of the new book, Lian Chao Han, and we're always delighted to catch up with him. Thanks so much for joining us again, Brad. Good to have you with us.
My pleasure, Frank. Thank you.
Let me ask you about the ferment that we're witnessing at the moment. Maybe we could start on the economic side and the manifestations of serious instability that prompted Ed Dowd, one of the smartest guys on Wall Street, to say China is done. Do you agree?
Well, there are three points to make with respect to this. First, that structurally, China has been growing at the World Bank estimates, doubling its economy in real terms every 8 years since the early 1990s. So structurally, they've grown very rapidly, and that's introduced tremendous problems in the Chinese economy. Secondly, we want to always keep in mind the Chinese economy has significant problems despite that growth. As Dowd recognized, the demographic problem is a very serious one, as well as the bubbles they've created within their own economies. Additionally, we could add the environmental...
For example, in banking and in real estate, right?
In banking, in real estate, in steel, in cement, so in essentially construction, and in other elements as well. The environmental problems, again, China is the world's largest polluter, and that has a negative consequence for their growth. And then, of course, fundamentally, it's the misrule of the Chinese Communist Party. The fact that China is ruled by thugs has an enormous economic cost associated with China. So Dowd is right that we're far past China's peak economy, and they have very real problems. The third point, of course, is that that's going to make them more aggressive in the immediate term. And that is, of course, very worrisome for the United States, its allies, and for Taiwan, all a very important problem.
Let's tease that out a bit. You are a serious academic scholar about China and I think about sort of tyranny more generally. When regimes get into this kind of trouble, Bradley Thayer, it is not uncommon for them, as again, Ed Dowd warned, to seek, as he put it, an external enemy outside of China that would be a basis upon which the Chinese party could be rallying their people, making essentially the argument that you have to put up with the repression, you have to tolerate the sacrifices and other hardships because we have this enemy. And it seems as though that enemy is not Taiwan alone, it is us. So their aggressiveness, I gather, would be vectored in our direction as well. Is that right?
Oh, absolutely, it is, and indeed it has been, Frank, since the Chinese Communist Party came to power in 1949, and really even before. But these economic problems that they face, you're exactly right. There's an issue that we study in international politics called social imperialism, and tyrannical regimes, as you noted, when they have domestic difficulties, look for external enemies to hype threats and to jump through windows of opportunity that may exist. For example, like coercing Taiwan, aggressing against Taiwan or India or other actors in international politics. We should expect this. Additionally, as Xi moves forward, Chinese leader Xi Jinping, as he moves forward to the 20th Congress, where he wants to instill himself, like Mao, essentially, and rule in perpetuity, taking an unprecedented third term, he's looking for wins. He's looking for external enemies that will help him legitimize this segue, this passage to an unprecedented third term for a modern Chinese Communist Party ruler.
And as he does that, the stakes obviously grow enormously. Some argue that the concern about getting sort of coronated, if you will, in the style of Mao, is going to offset the pressure he may feel for this social imperialism or social engineering, as you wish, that might cause this aggression to be manifested sooner rather than later. What book are you making on that timing question right there?
Well, one element we should always bear in mind is that the Chinese Communist Party will jump through windows of opportunity and they will surprise us. We should also condition any reflection on the fact that there's the fog of peace we always labor under, Frank, and that is that we assume there won't be aggression, that there won't be surprise attacks or aggression because there wasn't yesterday, there won't be today, and there won't be tomorrow. So keeping that in mind, we're seeing very important and worrisome signals cutting through the noise of, if you will, day-to-day life or the obfuscation of the Chinese Communist Party, that they're aggressing against India, that aggression is going to continue, the coercive action against Taiwan and against the United States. So my reflection is we should expect aggression from the Chinese Communist Party, heightened aggression beyond what we're seeing on a day-to-day basis, which is constant, which is perpetual as they seek to undermine us and overthrow us. We should be very alert to aggression that's precipitated immediately. That would be in the very near term.
That's my take too, and I think it's Ed Dowd's as well. Just a quick point on this. As we speak, we will shortly be recording a webinar on the People's War that the Chinese Communist Party declared against us in their main propaganda outlet, People's Daily, back in May of 2019. I think most Americans are completely unaware of this fact, let alone the unrestricted warfare they've been engaging in previously, now for decades. But this really, I think, brings home the point that you've just made, Brad, that they've been seeking to undermine us and indeed overthrow our constitutional republic for, well, some would argue from the inception of the Chinese Communist Party, but it's certainly ramping up at the moment. And I think surprise, point one, and the sense of opportunity as well as necessity all argues for us to be on our guard that this is potentially imminent and aimed not just at Taiwan, but at us as well. Brad, we have to take a quick break. We're going to come right back with more with Dr. Bradley Thayer about the Mar-a-Lago raid and how the Chinese Communist Party is reviewing that. That and more straight ahead. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Ed Dowd is one of Wall Street's most highly regarded experts. He just warned Steve Bannon's audience that, quote, China is collapsing, unquote. He added that, quote, internally, the Chinese communists are going to have to create an enemy outside of China to rally people around, unquote. Unfortunately, the Chinese Communist Party has already created that enemy, and it is us. Our webinar today will examine the People's War the CCP actually declared against America in May 2019. The Biden Pentagon would have us believe that China won't be ready to invade Taiwan for another 2 to 5 years. Maybe so. More likely, such whistling past the graveyard bespeaks the hope that we will be better prepared by then to defend against such a threat to Taiwan or to our assets, personnel, or territory. We need to get on a war footing now. Learn more at presentdangerchina.org. This is Frank Affney. Welcome back. We are having a very important, very timely conversation with Dr. Bradley Thayer, one of our country's foremost experts on China, the author of the forthcoming book, Understanding the China Threat, co-authored with Lan Chao Han. We're discussing in particular the prospect of imminent, old-fashioned, kinetic-style warfare with the Chinese Communist Party. Not just the sort that they've been waging against us of the, well, non-kinetic, economic, political, information, subversion, espionage kinds, but now, in addition, biological warfare, as we have found in our book, The CCP is at War with America. And Brad, one of the things that makes all the more worrying the prospect that the Chinese are calculating that they can get away with, well, murder, I think is in prospect, is the preoccupation of the United States with internal fractures and ferment about the, well, efforts to, I think, destroy Donald Trump, evident in this raid that the FBI conducted last week at Mar-a-Lago, his Florida home. You've written recently about how this kind of action is being perceived by the Chinese Communist Party. Give us a sense of both their takeaway from it all and what it might, again, portend for them to consider acting aggressively towards us as well as Taiwan.
Certainly, Frank. There are two major points. First, what happens domestically has an international impact. And so there are many states in international politics. Many of them are our allies, and some of them, China, most notably, are our enemies. So what's happening domestically is going to affect our allies and embolden our enemies. So when we have an event like the Mar-a-Lago raid, which violates a precedent, that is that obviously presidents don't raid former presidents' residences and seize documents. That's a violation of our political culture and norms of political life in the United States, to say nothing of the legal or the domestic political elements associated with that. Our allies like the United States because we have a very stable political culture. United States, when it makes a deterrent commitment, for example, is going to abide by that. And allies can be confident in America's credibility in large part because we have a very stable domestic political culture. We know what the rules are. We know what the norms and principles of behavior are domestically. The Mar-a-Lago raid violated that. That introduces doubt in our allies' minds whether the United States is a stable partner, is a stable ally. Additionally and concomitantly, that emboldens our enemies. China wants to see us defeated. They want to see us destroyed. And so a violation, crossing a Rubicon that was the Mar-a-Lago raid weakens the stature of the United States, the domestic stability of the United States, and emboldens China to aggress, further its aggression against the United States, our allies, and key partners like Taiwan.
Brad, I guess to summarize, all of this suggests that, among other things, what I've long believed and our Committee on the Present Danger China has incessantly warned about, namely the inadvisability of investing American savings and retirement funds and pension plans and mutual funds and, you know, exchange traded funds and index funds, on and on, all of this in Communist Chinese Party controlled companies is extremely ill-advised. I mean, for one thing, we're propping up the regime that is waging war against us and enabling it to be more powerful and more dangerous, among other things, towards us. But there's also now, if we're right in our shared assessment, that we may well find ourselves at war, the old-fashioned kind, with China, that these investors are likely to have their funds liquidated by the Chinese Communist Party. They'll not get it back. There was a very interesting aspect to a conversation that this chap Ed Dowd, formerly with BlackRock, the prime mover behind much of this transfer of wealth to China under the leadership of its chairman, Larry Fink. Ed, who was formerly an executive there, now independent of it, said he thinks Larry Fink is making a terrible mistake continuing to invest his clients' money in China. And I just wonder, we've seen a campaign mounted by a colleague of ours, Will Hild, of Consumers Research just recently, that sort of issued really a consumer's warning about going along with BlackRock this fashion, as well as its environment, social, and governance ESG agenda. But talk us through this. How serious a problem is it that with the collapse of these bubbles and the internal turmoil and the possibility of social imperialism, as you call it, and the distinct possibility of conflict, we must get these funds out of China right quick, no?
Indeed, we must. And we should have never invested them in the first place. That investment has made possible China's growth. We fund the CCP. We allow China to grow so rapidly. We created our enemy. We are all going to live with the consequences of that for many, many years.
If we're lucky, if we're not so lucky, we may not live to see the day. But the point is that this is bad business. We shouldn't have engaged in it before. But how urgent is it that we engage in a corrective action to disengage such funds from China as long as we still can?
It absolutely is urgent. First, it makes no sense to invest in China at all because they lie. There is no transparency with respect to investment. And the corruption of the party and the fact that that only helps to legitimize the Chinese Communist Party, our fundamental enemy in international politics. Secondly, the fact that this money is flowing, it could be going to American firms, it could be going to assist American veterans.
Invested patriotically.
Mm-hmm. Patriotic. So there's a huge opportunity cost associated with this money that we're paying. And thirdly, of course, it would allow us to rebuild our manufacturing, our infrastructure that we need to have in the United States, secure supply chain. So it's madness that we're allowing this to happen. There is a bit of a correction, Frank, as you observed, that the warning about BlackRock, former BlackRock employees, warning about investment in China. And you may have seen the leader, the opinion, the editorial in the Financial Times recently that warned about investment in China, stating that perhaps we should think about not investing in China. So even finance is recognizing that they have a huge problem. Of course, they should have recognized this a long time ago and have never committed to it, but it's important now that they are recognizing that. Now, can we follow through?
This is the key question. And I just wanted to put in a plug for our colleague, Kevin Freeman's National Security Investment Consultants Institute, which is training financial advisors as to the importance of not investing in our mortal enemy and investing instead, as you've said, patriotically. I can't emphasize enough how I think important this is, and strongly encourage people to check it out at nsic.org. Brad, we have to leave it at that for the moment. So much more to talk with you about, but I think you've covered the waterfront masterfully, as usual, and we look forward to visiting with you again in the very near future. We'll be right back with some highlights of our visit to CPAC right after this.
Garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Welcome back, and I am thrilled to be able to present to you our next speaker. We're among the many admirers of John Leake who are here at the Conservative Political Action Conference in Dallas, Texas, and we got a chance to talk with him on camera for your benefit, and I'm so pleased about it. He is the co-author with a man we've recently interviewed, Dr. Peter McCullough, of this terrific book, The Courage to Face COVID-2019, Preventing Hospitalization and Death While Battling the Biopharmaceutical Complex. John Leake is a very accomplished author. His specialty is true crimes, and there has never been, in my estimation, a greater true crime than this one. I think it's the scandal of the history of the world, truly, but it has all kinds of criminal elements to it. John, congratulations on this book. Thank you for taking a little bit of time to talk with us about it and co-authoring it with the man I've come to admire tremendously, Peter McCullough. I wanted to start with a question that's been weighing on me since I first heard about it. And it's not one of those things you just hear about. You can actually watch 7 hours of videotape concerning something called Event 201. Tell us what Event 201 was, who brought it to us, and the timing of it, which seems to be rather remarkable, and what flowed from it.
Event 201 was what the biopharmaceutical complex, as we call it in our book, what they call a pandemic planning exercise or simulation. It was held at the Johns Hopkins Center for Public Security, and that's an important phrase there, Center for Public Security, in collaboration with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and the World Economic Forum. There were a number of participants, but the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and the World Economic Forum were the prime sponsors of the event.
Underwriters.
And it was hosted at Johns Hopkins.
Right.
And what is a pandemic?
An outfit Michael Bloomberg is associated with, I believe.
Correct.
Is that right?
So a pandemic planning simulation, as we discovered in our research, there were several of them going all the way back to 2003.
Same sponsors, same participants.
And what's presented in these things is there's going to be another emergent infectious disease that will become a pandemic status. It will spread throughout the world. It's imminent. It's just a matter of time, too.
And what kind of disease was it?
Well, in this pandemic planning seminar or simulation event 201, it was a coronavirus.
A coronavirus.
A virulent
Imagine that.
Coronavirus.
That affects the respiratory system.
Respiratory tract. Some people, it's a mild cold-like symptom. In others, they have extreme difficulty breathing, causing the SARS syndrome, severe acute respiratory distress.
And this was, of course, something we learned about with an earlier Chinese
Correct.
Virus, SARS-1, as it's now been called.
And I think it's very important for everybody to understand that SARS that emerged in 03 was of immense interest to this complex. For years, there had been talk of the virulent influenza virus emerging that would have something like the virulence of the 1918 Spanish flu, but it really wasn't happening. There was a pretty nasty one in 57 and a pretty nasty one in 68, but they didn't have quite the same terror as SARS in 03. Now, SARS in 03 was pretty easily fizzled out. It was something that primarily spread in the hospital setting. It was fairly, because of its extreme virulence, was relatively easy to identify the symptoms. So it pretty quickly
it became
out.
Manageable in
yes.
other words.
But the thought was, well, isn't this interesting? It's not an influenza virus, it's a coronavirus, which we normally think of as a mild virus. I mean, coronavirus,
a flu.
Well, flu is typically influenza, and influenza
not a corona.
No. Coronaviruses, they exist in animals and humans. There are a lot of coronaviruses in humans that cause like a common cold syndrome.
Okay.
SARS in 03 was more virulent. Yeah. So this generated an immense amount of interest. So, okay, event 201, the theory is there are these things that are constantly emerging from nature. The first 200 of them don't really amount to much, but at any moment we could have 201, which it goes full pandemic, full virulence, can affect all of mankind. So how are we going to respond to it? In this pandemic planning seminar, two theoretical responses were presented. One is a repurposed viral drug, and in the simulation, it was an HIV drug repurposed to treat this coronavirus. That was one thing that was offered. The other solution offered was by a institution founded by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation in 2017 and the World Economic Forum. The two of them together jointly founded a new institution called the Center for Epidemic Preparedness Innovations.
CEPI.
No. This is explicitly presented in the simulation. You can see it on the video.
And so, two choices. They modeled both of them. One was more successful than the other?
CEPI, the representatives of CEPI say, look, the antiviral, maybe that could help a few people, but the real interest in this, the real high-tech solution that we are proposing and that CEPI is already working on is a new generation of vaccine technology that we already have in development against virulent coronaviruses.
And this would be modeled on the mRNA
Correct.
Gene
Correct.
Therapy.
Correct. So, we fast forward 3 months. Surprise, surprise, 3 months later, a virulent coronavirus.
There's a data point that we need to just mention, John. Among the participants in this Event 201 pandemic preparedness response exercise were the Central Intelligence Agency, I think the NIH, the Center for Disease Control, and the Chinese Centers for Disease Control.
Yes.
Which brings us to a couple of weeks later. What happened?
Well, what happened is this. We are told, what were we told happened? That, well, there's this strain syndrome that we're starting to detect in China. The Chinese are just now reporting on this. The WHO is just now getting up to speed on it. But there seems to be this syndrome, this viral syndrome, that causes, in some people at any rate, acute respiratory distress.
SARS-like syndrome.
SARS-like syndrome. It appears to be a coronavirus. It appears to be emerging from the Wuhan wet market, a sort of market of live animals, including
sea. We were being told
correct.
That that's where it came
it just
from,
so
by
happens,
the Chinese.
It just so happens that that wet market is a few miles away from a biosecurity level 4 lab attached to the Wuhan Institute of Virology.
Huh.
Where they're conducting gain-of-function research on bat coronaviruses. Mm. So that's one big thread of this story. But what is notable, we could go deep down that avenue, but what is immediately notable was on March the 16th, just 5 days after this thing is declared a pandemic by the WHO, the NIAID, Anthony Fauci's outfit, announces we have a new messenger RNA vaccine that we've developed with the Moderna Corporation in Cambridge, Massachusetts. We're getting it into human trials. We were already working on this.
Yes.
Yeah, this was something we've been interested in, a messenger RNA vaccine against a virulent coronavirus. So we've got it ready to go for human trials, and the manufacturing of the vaccine is courtesy of CEPI.
Interesting. When you say that it's ready for human trials, does that mean that it had been tested in the way that the FDA is supposed to have incrementally taken additional risk by, you know, making sure that it passed muster at the other lower stages, animal testing and that sort of thing?
Well, I mean, remember that the press release that the NIAID issued to the public doesn't go into all of the particulars of the background and regulatory processes and what was
just said that they were ready.
Yeah, we're just ready.
Ready for human testing.
It's sort of like there's a coronavirus and, well, we just happen to have a vaccine
shot
for it. I mean, there's a Simpsons episode in 2010 about cat fever. And the bosses of American corporate media say we need something to get people back in front of the television, glued to the set, and I think we ought to go with a public health scare. And we just happen to have a new agent that we... So it's kind of like...
life imitating art.
Yeah.
So John, the key piece of this, and we have to take a short break here in just a moment. You can stay with us, I hope, a little bit longer. Is that Bill Gates, who seems to have a passion for vaccination and public health, became a driving force behind this whole idea that the appropriate response to a pandemic caused by a coronavirus would be something that bears a striking resemblance to the way the Chinese Communist Party responded to this pandemic.
Yes.
Which was unprecedented, as I understand it. We're going to talk more about the China model and Bill Gates' role in bringing it to all of us and what it has meant for you, quite possibly, certainly for our country. That and more with John Leake of the courage to confront, to face COVID-19. Stay tuned.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Ed Dowd is one of Wall Street's most highly regarded experts. He just warned Steve Bannon's audience that, quote, China is collapsing, unquote. He added that, quote, internally, the Chinese communists are going to have to create an enemy outside of China to rally people around, unquote. Unfortunately, the Chinese Communist Party has already created that enemy, and it is us. Our webinar today will examine the People's War the CCP actually declared against America in May 2019. The Biden Pentagon would have us believe that China won't be ready to invade Taiwan for another 2 to 5 years. Maybe so. More likely, such whistling past the graveyard bespeaks the hope that we will be better prepared by then to defend against such a threat to Taiwan or to our assets, personnel, or territory. We need to get on a war footing now. Learn more at presentdangerchina.org. This is Frank Affney.
We're back, and we are once again joined, I'm pleased to say, by John Leek, the author of The Courage to Face COVID-19, which he co-authored, I should say, with Dr. Peter McCullough, one of the great medical, I think, figures in our country at the moment, and certainly a leader in the effort to expose what has actually happened to us as a result of, well, what I think is the greatest scandal in human history, the pandemic, known as COVID-19, and the response to it by our government, political figures of various types, and of course by others around the world. John, we introduced before we had to take a short break this idea of the China model. Help us understand what that is and whence it came.
Well, the Chinese model of public health response, pandemic response, is purportedly based on the concept of contagion control. You have an emerging pathogen, and the first thing you do is you lock everything down.
Right.
I mean, it's not identify ill individuals and place them in quarantine. I mean, it's put a cordon around the entire city and lock everybody up.
Weld's apartment buildings
right.
shut.
Right, and knock, nail the door shut.
Right.
And that is obviously not palatable to the tradition going back to the founding fathers of this constitutional republic. Our founding fathers perceived life to contain some elements of risk. A prudent citizenry isn't a citizenry that you can lock up under, because there is an apparent emergency.
Right.
Interestingly enough, in 2011, the Rockefeller Foundation published a document presenting hypothetical scenarios for what's likely to afflict mankind in the 21st century. One of them is an emerging disease pandemic from China, and the title of the hypothetical scenario in this document is lockstep. China will show the way to responding to the pandemic, and all of the other nation states of the world will fall into lockstep with the Chinese model.
Did the World Health Organization play a role in facilitating that adoption of the China model in the scenario that you described?
What you see with the World Health Organization is that it has done an absolutely astonishing job of building both financial, but also, I would call it lobbying relationships with national heads of state and the heads of national bureaucracies. You know, I think it's remarkable that how much the World Economic Foundation is now, it's almost like Switzerland in the High Alps. I mean, I can't help but being reminded of Spectre in the James Bond novels.
Yeah.
We'll pull together
the heart of
all
darkness.
Of our friends and treasuries and defense establishments. Some of these guys are even heads of state.
Yeah.
I mean, Justin Trudeau.
And they're just down the road from Davos, of course, where these guys also convene for similar purposes.
Correct.
So we've seen certainly in the course of this pandemic, the World Health Organization helping impose the China model worldwide.
Absolutely.
And a sizable percentage of the budget of the World Health Organization, as I understand it, comes from, wait for it, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation.
Absolutely.
Is that right?
Correct.
So to the extent he's driving this train on vaccinations, he's trying to get the mandates that are part and parcel of the Chinese model, to the extent that he's underwriting the international or multinational organization that is helping to impose, really, this approach worldwide, all roads seem to lead back to Bill Gates, to some extent.
Mr. Gates. Well, I mean, he's a remarkable man. I mean, for a long time, he was the wealthiest man in the world. I estimated that the fortune that belongs to Bill Gates, it's published, working at the American median household income of about $70,000 a year, if you saved all of it, didn't lose a penny to inflation or taxation, and you earned $70,000 a year, how many years would you have to work in order to amass Bill Gates' fortune? Can you guess? What, you'd have to work 1.7 million years.
Wow.
So that amount of capital and firepower, particularly as it's vested in this foundation, which has enormous leeway for operating across all jurisdictions, there's tax advantages, the money that his foundation invests in can be recaptured by the foundation and used to do other. It is an immensely powerful organization. And Bill Gates, we know from the Sherman Antitrust action the Justice Department filed in 1998, he has a very monopolistic spirit. He wanted every man, woman, and child to have a Windows operating system paired with a Netscape browser. And he seems to have shifted
nobody
that.
Else need apply, right?
Right, yeah. Precisely.
And you also mentioned off air that the contempt that he exhibited towards the people who were prosecuting him for those antitrust violations was pretty extraordinary, yeah, too.
Yes, it's interesting to watch the video recordings of his interviews with the Department of Justice.
This is a man who has a lot of baggage, I think it's fair to say. And
yes.
Some believe, as I do, that among them is that he's a eugenicist. He's a guy who actually thinks there's too many people in the world, and what he's about is trying to reduce that population, which makes it a little scary that he's buying up a lot of agricultural land in this country and using his wealth for all these other purposes, including vaccines that wind up being, as Dr. McCullough said to us, hazardous to our health.
There is a piece of an utterance that he made at a TED Talk, and if I remember correctly, it was a 2010 TED Talk. And the lecture was, how do we reduce greenhouse gas? How do we reduce carbon emissions? And he has this very simple mathematical formula. And the first factor in the equation is population.
Yeah. You got to reduce the number of people in order to reduce all this gas emission. Stand by. We're going to ask you to stay with us for one more block. Can we do that?
Yeah.
Great. John Leake is in the house virtually here at CPAC. And we are thrilled to have a chance to visit with him at some length about this terrific book. He's co-authored with Dr. Peter McCullough, The Courage to Face COVID-19. We're going to talk more about what else you need to know about the people who perpetrated it on us right after this. We're back, and we're going to conclude with this segment, our conversation with John Leake, the co-author with Dr. Peter McCullough of a terrific new, I think best-selling book entitled The Courage to Face COVID, Preventing Hospitalization and Death While Battling the Biopharmaceutical Complex, a key feature of which is not only the U.S. government and regulatorily captured agencies of it, like the FDA and the Centers for Disease Control and Fauci's operation, but also the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, the vehicle for advancing the agenda of Bill Gates. You were talking about some of his personal qualities as well as his predilections. How have those been manifested most dramatically in this pandemic exercise?
Well, we were talking about how Mr. Gates seems to have two major aspirations for mankind, vaccinating all of mankind and reducing greenhouse gas emissions, carbon emissions. He gave a TED talk in which he said one of the things that we could do to reduce greenhouse gas emissions is reduce the population. How do we do that? And he says if we do a really good job with vaccines and family planning, we could reduce the population by 15%. That is a remarkable utterance. One doesn't normally think of vaccines as a vehicle for reducing human population. Normally you think that it enables people to live
and prosper.
And prosper and reproduce.
Right.
So there seems to be in his own utterances something worthy of examination of this immensely powerful, well-capitalized guy who has a sort of obsessive interest in this.
Vaccinations. In reducing greenhouse gases, in using population reduction to accomplish these things.
Correct.
It's like, as I think you said earlier, a dystopian, you know, sort of horror show, really. And he has been using his wealth to impose it, literally, worldwide. So when you look at his foundation, one of the other things that you shared with me, John, is the modeling that he's done on that foundation sort of purpose and structure and priorities, the Rockefeller Foundation. They've been partnering, I gather, increasingly with the Gates Foundation. What insights do we take from that as a kind of wellspring for his approach
philanthropy? Historians of American economy and finance in 1998, 2000, when Mr. Gates had this conflict with the U.S. Department of Justice, he was frequently compared to John D. Rockefeller for these sort of monomaniacal, monopolistic energy. John D. wanted everyone to buy Standard Oil petroleum, and anyone else, you know, who wasn't working for Standard Oil could just, you know, die. And Bill Gates wanted everyone to have a Windows, operating system and a Netscape browser. This monopolistic spirit is something that seems to have been transferred both in John D. Rockefeller and Bill Gates from their initial industrial enterprises to public health policy. And what I think
as priorities of their respective
correct
philanthropies.
Correct. I think that why public health? With Rockefeller, you might say, well, you know, it's at any rate appears to be altruism. I mean, and I have to admit, in the early days, the Rockefeller Foundation did some good work. For example, the reduction of hookworm in the American South. That was largely a Rockefeller initiative. But Gates, in particularly his cooperation with the World Economic Forum, it seems to be much more about control, global governance. The emergence of an infectious disease is almost akin to the emergence of a hostile military force. I mean, you know, instead of the Germans invading all of Europe in 1939, 40, and 41, it's an infectious disease.
Germs.
It's germs, precisely. So that massive emergency countermeasures are invoked. Public treasuries in nations all over the world are to, under the guise that we have the expertise, to respond to this. We have the technology and the know-how. You politicians need to come to us for the response. So there's an immense amount of power that can be accrued through
and
this mechanism.
Gates' collaboration, not only with Davos, which is, of course, a matter of record, but also with the Chinese Communist Party, has brought about, it would seem, another convergence again. Bill Gates as a prime mover behind the China model's implementation and imposition by the World Health Organization, which he sponsors. So, I mean, am I drawing too many
dots? No, I don't. I mean, I think American capitalism has sort of fallen in love with a lot of Chinese ways of doing business. There is an immense efficiency and just this top-down authoritarian hierarchical structure of capitalism. So there have been a lot of alliances between American captains of industry and Chinese agents. Let's put it, and it's in academia. It's the life.
Part
of
what we call elite capture.
Correct.
Of those engines of our country, really, John, I'm sorry to say we've run out of time about without having exhausted the topic by any means, but I really appreciate the chance to both have this conversation with you, and I hope set the stage for the next one, because I think what your insights are telling us is we have really been subjected to a strategy for transforming our country under the guise of a public health emergency. And the engines of that, the elites that have been involved, governmental and private sector, are formidable. This is a topic to which we will return. Thank you for your time today, as well as for this terrific book, The Courage to Face COVID-19. Come back soon.
Yes,
and
sir.
Let's continue it. And
thank you.
In the meantime, I hope the rest of you will come back soon. We're going to talk with other folks you're going to be interested in hearing from in the near future. And until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for watching.